All right, everyone. So let's come back to the questions. Lots of questions again, which is wonderful. People are getting engaged, which is always very nice. So let us start. So, dear Ajahn, today must be the third time I listened to your teaching on taking up arms, Sutta. I still found it very inspiring and touching for the third time listening to your teaching of the Sutta. May you be well and happy and continue teaching the Sutta. So that is, I'm very happy to hear that because I guess like many people, I tend to repeat myself a lot. But actually, repetition, if it's done in the right way, actually is very interesting. It allows you to go deeper into the suttas, to understand the material from kind of slightly different angles every time. And so I am very happy that you approve, because I actually like to do that in this way. So very good. So excellent. All right. Gee, okay. okay, I'll do some shorter questions first. I'll come back to that one later on and see what happens. Okay, dear Ajahn, thank you for the brilliant teachings. King Makadeva went to the homelessness when he saw a grey hair. He had no worries to leave his family, as the whole palace is there to support them. Same as Prince Siddhartha's case. But if we see grey hair, we can't do it, even if we want to go, as there are not many people to support our families. So if we practice at home as much as we can, is it possible to attain Sotapanna? Thank you, with metta. Well, I think the thing is that whether it is possible to attain Sotapanna or not is kind of beside the point. What you have to ask yourself is what you can do. And sometimes it is, as you say, it is impossible sometimes to go forth, and sometimes you just have to live the home life. And if you have to, you have to make the best of it. And whether you actually it is possible to train stream entry or not is, who knows? It's kind of not the main issue. The issue is whether you are able to go forth or not. That's really the issue. And so you make the decision that you have to make, and then you make the most of your circumstances, whether you are a monastic or a layperson, and then you go as far as you possibly can on that path. And it is not always necessarily the right thing for someone to go forth. Sometimes it's just too difficult. Sometimes you may not enjoy the monastic life. It depends on your tendencies and your personality and all kind of things, whether it really is going to work out for you. So for some people, it might actually be better to be a layperson. Maybe they make more progress in lay life. It's very hard to say. What you have to do is you have to try it out. Come to the monastery for a while, see if you enjoy it. And if you enjoy it, then maybe it is the right thing for you. So it really depends on so many factors, what is the right thing to do. So don't worry about whether you can attain stream entry. I think that's the wrong way of approaching it. Ask yourself instead what you can do, and then try out a little bit the different ways and see what happens when you do that, and then make decisions accordingly. I think that is the right way. If I tell you that you can't become a stream mentor as a layperson, it probably doesn't change your circumstances, right? You still have to do what you have to do. So it's not. I don't think it's the helpful way of thinking about it. All right. So there you are. Putting that to one side. Dear Ajahn, there appears to be many Buddhist customs and rituals, for example, bowing and chanting. Are they important, and how does one learn them? Yes, there are many Buddhist customs and rituals. Are they important? Well, they can be important. What really matters is what we make out of them, right? And sometimes there can be too many rituals. Sometimes there may not be enough. It is good. I think it's nice to have a little bit of rituals and customs. But sometimes it can go overboard, and sometimes you kind of just end up chanting all the time and these kind of things, and that's not really useful either. So if you're going to do bowing, for example, then how should you bow is more important than actually just the mechanics of bowing. When you bow, you what you're bowing down to is, we have the Buddha statue here, represents the Buddha, also represents the Dhamma and the Sangha in a sense. And then when you bow down to the Buddha statue, what you're bowing down to is like these beautiful qualities that are represented by the Buddha. Wisdom, compassion, understanding, because that is what the Buddha is. The Buddha isn't really a person in the ordinary sense anymore. He has gone beyond having an ego, and if there is no ego, all that is left are really these beautiful qualities that have been developed. And when you bow down to compassion, when you bow down to kindness, when you bow down to wisdom, it means that you respect those qualities. And when you respect those qualities, they grow inside of you. So bowing down is actually a way of encouraging the growth of those qualities within you. Yeah, so when you bow, remember what you're bowing to. And then you actually build up that potential for those qualities to grow inside of you because you respect them. That is what you really are respecting when you bow down to these things. Then it becomes very useful. It becomes very powerful. I would really recommend everyone to bow, because bowing is a very beautiful act once you kind of understand how it works and what it is. It's also kind of a way of realizing that there are things in the world that are greater than you. You are kind of your ego, your sense of self. From a Buddhist point of view, it is all a bit of a delusion anyway. So let's instead bow down to something greater than us, like a potential within us, where we want to go. And when you do that, it actually feels very positive if you get it in the right way. So bowing is useful. But again, don't just bow all the time mechanically. Then it stops having that effect. But try to make something out of it. As for the chanting, it again depends on how you do it and why you do it and all of these kind of things. I would say it is useful, especially if you understand some of the content. And that's why I like to do the Metta Sutta in English in the morning, so you have some understanding of what is going on. But just by chanting those words and remembering that these are the words of the Buddha, when just listening to those words can often be enough to sort of incline the heart in that direction and maybe even give rise to some of those feelings. That's kind of the idea here. Or it can be a chant in Pali, and even if it just makes you feel peaceful, that's already useful, because that sense of peace can then be taken further in your meditation practice, and it becomes the kind of the chanting and the meditation, etc. It all works together. Or maybe you understand some of the words, even if it's a Pali chanting, and maybe some of the words mean something to you. And again, it can be something that encourages you in your practice. So be wise about these things. Use them wisely. Don't use them mechanically. So much on the Buddhist path can become just mechanical. Even meditation can become mechanical. I'm a Buddhist. I have to meditate every day. Whatever. And I kind of... It becomes kind of useless, if you just become like a zombie who meditates every day without really investigating what is going on. So be wise about these things. Then these things are useful. All right. Dear Ajahn, is the Sutta Nipata a later addition compared to the Majjhima Nikaya, Sanghita Nikaya, etc.? So, in other words, the Sutta Nipata, which is the one of the sutta we looked at today, the Atadanda Sutta, taking up of punishment or whatever, that is part of the collection called the Sutta Nipata. And is that collection, is it later than the middle-length sayings, the connected sayings, all of these kind of things? The answer is that most of the Sutta Nipata is probably quite goes back all the way to the beginning of Buddhism, but especially so the last two chapters. There's five chapters in that book, and the last two, known as the Attakavaga and the Parayanavaga, they go back to the very earliest times. And we know that because the verses in in these chapters are quoted elsewhere in the Pali canon. So it belongs to the very earliest level of suttas. So it depends a little bit where, which part of the collection you look at. Some of the suttas there may not be, maybe be a little bit later, but certainly the sutta we looked at today is part of the very earliest part of that, of the suttas that we have, probably going, most likely going back to the Buddha himself. So when you come to the Kuddhaka Nikaya, it's a bit more complex. Yeah, the Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, Sanghita Nikaya, and Anguttara, the long, middle-length, connected, and numerical discourses, tend to be, all of them, quite authentic, yeah, going back to the time of the Buddha. The Kuddhaka Nikaya, the shorter collection, is a bit more of a mixed bag. Yeah, so it's a bit more, takes a bit more discernment to decide what is the earliest and what is not so early here. Yeah. That's a rough guide for you right there. All right, dear Ajahn, when the Buddha is recounting his going forth, he states that my mother and father wished otherwise, weeping with tearful faces. In hindsight, his decision was beneficial since he helped countless beings after his enlightenment. But how can we, as ordinary people with faith in the teaching, know whether going forth will be a skillful decision, even though it may result in a degree of suffering to our family? Your thoughts on the matter are much appreciated. Well, it is very rare that it does not result in some degree of suffering for your family. It is very hard. I mean, very few families want their sons or daughters to go forth. Yeah. When I decided to become a monk, certainly I cannot tell you, my parents did not approve. They were not happy. But I said, I didn't really say very much. I just was stubborn. I just said, I'm going to go forth regardless. Yeah, please give me permission. Okay, you can go forth. And this is how often it is, yeah, because you don't want your, most people don't want their sons and daughters to become monastics. It's like losing your son and daughter. That's what it feels like to most people. And so we cannot really wait till our parents allow us, because there wouldn't be any monastics in the world if we waited for that. Sometimes we just have to say, okay, this is a bigger issue. It is more important. And very often, if you end up living your monastic life well, actually, after a while, your parents are very grateful that you were a bit stubborn, because they didn't really understand what this was about. And just because you come from a Buddhist country doesn't necessarily mean that your family will understand, right? Because very often, you are a traditional Buddhist, doesn't necessarily mean you have a profound insight into these teachings. The right way of dealing with this really is that you just try it out. Yeah, so you test it out. You come to the monastery, you stay for a while, you feel what it feels like, and you sort of gradually come to a conclusion whether this is going to work for you or not. And then, if you really feel that it's going to work for you, it's going to be positive. You have maybe a strong sense of confidence and faith in these teachings. Then you make a decision, and you're not too concerned about whether your family approves or not, because again, it's never going to happen if you wait for that. And then you do it, and then you live the life of a monastic well. And if you live the life of a monastic well, it is kind of miraculous what happens on the path. And one of the miracles that you find is that your parents, very often, they will come around. Your family will come around. And after a while, they will say, yay, well done. What a wonderful thing it is that you are a monastic. Yeah, and that's very beautiful when that happens. So this is what I would recommend. If you have the really, really wise parents, they would encourage their children to go forth. Yeah, please go forth. But I don't want to go forth. Go forth anyway. Yeah, that's kind of, if you really understand what this is about, that's what you would do. So sometimes if you have some very kind of intelligent and smart kind of, sons and daughters or whatever, they are the ones you should really tell, encourage to go forth. But I want to be a doctor. Never mind being a doctor. Become a nun instead. That is what really matters. Then you kind of really understand what is at stake. Because there are so many doctors in the world. Doctors, of course, are very helpful, very useful. But a good monastic is far more helpful than any doctor can ever be. All right. Dean Ajahn, can you please recommend books that draw out the translation of the suttas, like you are doing here, so I can continue to study after the retreat? The best thing to do is to go to the BSWA website and to listen to the talks given there. Lots of sutta studies are available. Some of them are really long and extensive. Some of the suttas go on for kind of talk after talk after talk because they are very long and beautiful suttas. So that's what I would do. You don't really, there isn't that many books available who that draw these things out in this particular way. So better to listen to recordings of these things. So read the sutta for yourself and then listen to someone who understands what is going on. And there's many people who have good understanding of the suttas. It can be, you know, Ajahn Brahm or someone like Bhante Sujata or Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, and etc., etc. And you can kind of find your favorite teacher and listen to that. And there's many others as well who have a really good understanding of what is going on. That's what I would recommend you to do. All right. Dear Ajahn, was Jung interested in dreams because it gives us insight into our unconscious? Is there a Buddhist parallel to the ideas of conscious and conscious mind, or is it just about whether we have sati, eye awareness, or not? Yes, it seems like Jung was, he was talking about the unconscious, and that unconscious, the dreams, kind of give you access to the unconscious. I think that's what Jung was about. I don't really know anything much about Jung, but that seems to have been what it was. Now, of course, unconscious is a loaded term. What exactly does it mean? I don't think it means unconscious in the way of not having any kind of consciousness. It is more a kind of a very rudimentary form of consciousness, I think is what he meant by unconscious, apparently. So it is getting access to that more rudimentary aspect of consciousness. Is there a Buddhist parallel to the idea of conscious, unconscious mind? And is it just about whether we have sati awareness or not? I suppose that there may very well be a Buddhist parallel, in the sense that the more that there are many aspects of the mind that we are not fully aware of, and that we don't really consider properly, because the mind is so complex and there's so many things going on, and most of the things in our mind just kind of you see it so briefly that you forget about it straight away, and it is kind of unconscious because of that. But yes, it is really about sati and awareness. The more sati you have, the more ability you have to see all the aspects of the mind. And of course, what that means is that the more sati you have, the more awareness you have, you can see all of the little cravings, the little desires, the little problems that are there. And it allows you to steer clear of those things because you have that awareness. You understand your problems better, how you react to people in the world and all of these kind of things, and then you can deal with them because of that. So really, yes, I think it comes down ultimately to more awareness, more sati, and then uncovering these processes that can be very fast and very subtle, and seeing this more clearly as a consequence. All right. Dear Ajahn, there are many versions of the translation of the Sutta Nipata. Which version do you think is the most accurately translated? The current version that we are using is from which translation? The version we're using now is Bhante Sujato's translation, and it is available on suttacentral.net. It is actually available as a printed version as well, but the main version is online, and you can see it all there. I would think that that is a fairly accurate translation. It is based on many of the previous translations, and because it is based on other people who also are good translators, you can consider it to be a good one. Another one that I like is Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation of the Sutta Nipata. It is also very, I think, very accurate. Maybe some differences with Bhantasujata, but in general, very beautiful and accurate the way he translates. And I think those are the two main ones that I would recommend. There are some others that are perhaps also interesting, but I think this is what I would recommend. Some of the translations are far too free. A free translation means that the kind of the translator just feels the text more than really considers what actually the Buddha is saying. And kind of this idea of feeling the text is very dangerous. You have to really know the language and analyze the grammar, etc., to get the meaning. Because feelings are unreliable. Feelings come from delusion very often, and very often you will misrepresent the Buddha. And that's a very bad idea, to misrepresent the Buddha. Our job as a translator is always to represent the Buddha as accurately as we possibly can. That is what I would recommend. So try those two translations and see what happens. Okay, dear Ajahn, when one dies, which part of the mind extinguishes and which gets recycled? What is a ghost? Have you ever seen one? When you die, which part of the mind extinguishes? When you die, you essentially take the mind with you, right? You essentially kind of bring that mind on with you. But of course, what happens when you die is that you recognize that so many of the things from this life, you have to let go of those things. You can't really take them with you. And so you tend to forget about things in this life. So when you get reborn in a new realm or whatever, that past life really starts to fade very quickly because now you are interested in new things. But many of the underlying things are still there. The underlying habits, the underlying traits of the mind will be there. So for example, you may have a certain trait that maybe you have certain desires that are very strong for you, certain particular kind of people that you like, particular kind of people that you dislike. And these traits, these underlying tendencies, this is what you will take with you into the future. And that is what really matters. Because the superficial things in this life are kind of what our life is like. But the important things is the nature of our mind, whether it's wholesome or unwholesome or neutral. And that is what you bring with you. And that is kind of scary, right? Because it means that if you have a tendency to unwholesome qualities of the mind, you take those with you into the future. And where you get reborn in the future, because you don't know what's going to happen, given the wrong circumstances, these terrible mind states may kind of bloom. They may become very powerful. And then you do all kind of bad things as a consequence. Why? Because you didn't get reborn in a nice Buddhist family. You get reborn into some dodgy family somewhere. Some mafia family or something, right? And when your mafia family says, go out and perform these crimes, you will say, yes, sir, or yes, ma'am, and you will go out and perform those crimes. Because that is what it's like when you're part of a family. This is kind of the problem of attachment in the world. We do what other people want us to do. So it's kind of scary to have these defilements in the mind, because these are the things that will lead you astray in the future. So make sure that you overcome these things as much as possible. Build up the good qualities. So this is kind of what carries on. Of course, the memories of your present life will also be there, deeply buried somewhere in your mind. And if you're able to recall your past lives, you will remember those things and it will look like you. There I was in my past life. It doesn't look like someone else. It looks like you are there. And you will see these things in your mind's eye. But generally, the details of a life tend to get blurred after when you get reborn, because it's no longer so interesting. What is a ghost? A ghost is like you. You are a ghost. Can you feel your inner ghost? It's there, right? You have been a ghost before. You will be a ghost again in the future. So a ghost is like a mind-made body. And ghost is someone who is or a being that is not as happy as human beings. There's more suffering because you don't really get satisfied all your desires very much. You may have lots of desire, but little satisfaction of those desires. And so it's quite a lot of suffering to be a ghost. It is kind of one realm down from the human realm. But we all have the ghost within us. We have been ghosts in the past, we'll be ghosts again in the future. It is just a realm of, it's a name for a particular realm of existence. Peta loka. Peta literally means departed. So the departed are what we call here ghosts in this particular case. And they are just like you. It's kind of weird. It is nothing kind of foreign about it, nor is there anything foreign about being a god or a deva. It's like you get reborn, you think, oh, I'm a ghost now. Oh no, I'm a ghost. And it's kind of concerning because you know that, well, now I'm probably going to have a bit of suffering because I got reborn as a ghost. But it feels like you. You're just there. But now you have a different body. It's nothing foreign about it. Same thing, you get reborn as a deva. Oh, I'm a deva now. Yay, I'm a deva. Hooray. Now I can enjoy myself. I can get trapped in samsara for a little bit longer because of all the joys of the deva realm. That's kind of the downside. But anyway, you kind of indulge so much, you forget about that very quickly. Unless you're really wise, and you become like Sakka, you come down to the Buddha and ask a few questions. Have I ever seen a ghost? I'm not sure if it's the right thing to answer. I know monks who have seen ghosts. Let me put it that way. It's quite not that uncommon. There are lay people who see ghosts as well. This happens quite commonly in the world. And it is great to see a ghost. Sometimes people think it is scary to see a ghost, but actually you should feel very lucky if you have seen a ghost. So if you have any doubts and you're not sure, you should say, ghost, please come. I want to see you. Is that right? So, when you go back home and it's kind of dark or whatever, you should say, ghost, please come now. I would like to see you. I would like to say hello. Instead of being afraid of the ghost. And the reason you should do that is because if you see something like that, it opens your eyes to a broader aspect of reality. If you never see a ghost, you may doubt their existence. But if you see something with your own eyes or with your own mind or whatever it is, it opens up the potential, opens up the possibility of actually seeing something deeper about the nature of the world. And this allows you to approach the Buddhist teachings in a new way. So it's wonderful to see these other realities. Please don't be afraid of these ghosts. They are a potential for improving your spiritual practice by broadening out the scope for what actually exists in this world. What can we do to make ghosts appear during this retreat, Venerable Ananda? Is there anything we can do? I'm not sure. No, we're not going to. I'm just messing around. So anyway, what happens, happens. So. Okay, let's go on to the next one. Dear Ajahn, my brother is into black magic and spells. I am worried for him. How do I help him to abandon the wrong view and the wrong practice? What you have to do is you have to tell him that doing bad things to other people, it's immoral. And if you're into black magic, basically black magic means that you are doing bad things. Whether they work or not is kind of irrelevant. Even just the intention to do black magic is bad, right? So just tell him to be kind to other people. Don't kind of mess around in the world of these things. Is there such a thing as black magic? I think maybe there is. The world is complicated. The world is full of weird stuff. It may very well be possible to do all kinds of bad things in this way. I think very often it is exaggerated. A lot of the things that we think are black magic actually are not. But maybe occasionally there is such a thing. But just tell your brother to live well. I don't know if he's a Buddhist or what, but if he's a Buddhist, then remind him that it is kindness that is powerful in the world. Kindness overcomes the problems. Cursing other people and kind of doing stuff, which is, even if it's just with the mind, is a very, very bad idea. So he's destroying his own future by doing bad things towards other people. So just some gentle reminders of what actually is important in life. Maybe that will work. I don't know what if it will or not. But anyway, good luck. See what happens. Okay, dear Ajahn, referring to the last sentence of Sanyutta Nikaya 1.1, crossing the flood, is there any significance to why the deity circled the Buddha, keeping him on his right? Yes, there is. This is what we normally call the circumambulation. And you may have seen this. This happens quite commonly in the monastery. You may circumambulate the sutta. It's called padakina. And this circumambulation is always with the right shoulder, because the right shoulder is often bare. Yeah, you have a bare shoulder, and then you circumambulate it with a bare shoulder towards the stupa, or in this case, towards the person. So you circle the Buddha, and this is kind of the traditional way of paying respect to the Buddha, with a bare shoulder towards him. And I guess that's a bit like the handshake in the West. Yeah, when you shake someone's hands, it's like saying, I don't have a weapon, and I am kind of coming on friendly terms. In the same way, when you bare your shoulders, it's like you're saying, I don't really, you know, there's no weapons here or nothing bad. I'm coming on in a friendly way. This kind of the idea behind this. So this is why even in the present day we do the similar kind of things in the Buddhist world. So things have really remained the same for a long, long time. And it probably goes back to pre-Buddhist times, actually, to the kind of culture of India at that time. Okay. Dear Dr. Ajahn, okay. Okay, good. From a Buddhist ethical, a Buddhist moral philosophical point of view, how should we think about the ideas of monogamy and polygamy? What would you say about ethical non-monogamy? When posed a question like this, how do you see Buddhist teachings that you have learned or wisdom that you have developed over the years to conceptualize about this? In the suttas at the time in ancient India, there certainly were people who had many, there were men who had many wives. This seems to have been a common thing, and maybe also, I don't know of any examples of the other way around, of women who had many husbands, but of course that would just be the mirror of the other one, so there should be the same idea, really. And so that didn't seem to be a problem. Yeah, the Buddha never said it was bad. And so I don't think it is really an issue. Of course, in our Western society, normally it is not done. And it's, I think, often actually it is actually illegal even. I'm not sure what it is like here in Australia. Probably is illegal, I'm not sure. But it's not really considered a bad thing from a Buddhist point of view. Of course, it has to be voluntary. That's kind of the bottom line. But as long as it is voluntary, it is not necessarily considered a bad thing. What is bad is always in Buddhism is how you treat people. You treat people well, it's okay. Treat people badly, that is when it is bad. That's really the bottom line. I'm not sure if there's much more to be said about that. All right. Ajahn, alternative idea as to why parents are not mentioned in the Majjhima Nikaya Sutta discussed. Mother and father are inherent. Partners and children, we go out of our way to acquire. Thoughts. Yes, that might be part of it, because you go out of the way to kind of, you acquire these things, then you can say that you can stop yourself from acquiring them, because it's really a choice, whereas parents is not really a choice. So that's true, and that may be part of it. But obviously, you have to let go of your attachments to your parents as well. For example, you may, especially when it comes to all these animals they're talking about in the suttas, very often those animals will be part of the family that you grow up in. And so they will be also be kind of a given when you grow up, just like your parents might be a given when you grow up. That could be partly the truth. Also, you are going to have to give up the broader attachments, whatever they really are. A bit of both, maybe. Okay. Hi, Ajahn. How can we go forward after the nimitta, the bright circle light, comes? Thank you for your valuable teaching. The way you present is so interesting. Straight away, joy comes to our mind by thinking we have the great teachers like you, Ajahn Brahm, and other monks. Thank you. Okay, that's very good. I'm very happy to hear that. How can you go forward after the nimitta, the bright circle light, comes? So if you are doing well in your meditation and you're getting these kind of experiences, that is wonderful. And what you have to do is just stay with those nimittas. Stay with them. And if you stay with them in the right way, with patience, by focusing in the center of these things, they will tend to change, they will grow, and they will become more powerful. So the idea is to stay with them and allow them to grow. And they will grow in brightness. They will grow in happiness. They will grow in the focus will become sharper and sharper as you do that, more and more unified around this object that you're seeing, the bright circle of light. This is the way into the deep states of samadhi, the jhanas and these kind of things, right? So keep on focusing on that, keep on staying with it, being with it, as I've been saying before. Don't try to focus or anything like that, just be with it. And then as you do that, you will see these changes and gradually taking you all the way into deep samadhi. That's kind of the purpose of this, getting all the way to the jhana states. That's wonderful. I'm very happy that you're getting such nice results. And just keep on being patient, and hopefully you can take it even further here. Okay, so now we come to the long question, which I have left till the end. Oops. Dear Venerable Ajahn, may I please make the following comments on two of the questions that were raised last night for your kind comment, Ajahn. One, I think there is enough evidence in the suttas to disprove the theory that the Buddha-to-be was born a once-returner or any other Magapala-labhi, one who has attained Magapala. Here are two of them, Ajahn. In the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the passage starting with the words Pubbe ananusuteyesu dhammesu, teaching is not learned before from another, proves that the Buddha discovered the path from the beginning. That is my view, Ajahn. Pubbe ananusuteyesu dhammesu means Ananusuteyasa means unheard, Dhamma is teachings, and Pubba means before, so previously unheard teachings. I would say, I mean, you know, you might argue, perhaps, I don't know, this is not my argument, but someone might argue that it means in this life, not heard earlier in this life, because what happened in the past life has kind of been forgotten. You don't really have it anymore. So that might be the alternative argument. But I tend to agree with you. I don't really necessarily agree with this idea that the Buddha was a once-returner or a stream-enterer. Number two, when the Buddha met Upaka, the Ajivaka, the Buddha told Upaka, I have no teacher. That's exactly right. By that time, the Buddha has gained the three knowledges and has seen his many past lives. If he was a once-returned or stream mentor from the previous life, the Buddha would have seen that and told Upaka that the Buddha Kassapa was his teacher. Yes, that is quite right. That may very well have been what happened. And again, I tend to agree with you, and I think this is basically right. But there may be possible, again, that what the Buddha means by no teacher is like no teacher in this life rather than teacher in the past. Whether the Buddha had remembered his time under Buddha Kassapa and all of that, it's all very moot and very difficult to really know exactly what happened. It's all very uncertain. But yes, I do. I tend to agree with what you're saying here. So, continued. So, with that meeting with Upaka is more proof that the Buddha discovered the Dhamma, the deathless, or as I would say, the freedom from death and Nibbana. Okay, next one. Someone raised the question, why the mother and father, okay, here we are again, are not included in the list of items that are subject to old age, sickness, corruption, etc. Ajahn, my view is that that list contains the person's assets that one actually seeks out. So that's exactly what the other person was saying. Yeah, the ignoble search, right? So you are searching for things. So that's a good point, because it is about the ignoble search, but whereas parents are a given. One cannot seek out one's parents. One can seek out the partner and consequences, children, but not the parents. I think that is why the parents are not included in the list. Thank you much for the inspiring teachings. Yes, I think that is a sensible point of view, and I think that may very well be why it is not there. So, there you are. That is all the questions for tonight. And I wish you all a very good night. Have a nice rest. And I will see you again tomorrow morning. Yeah. Okay. Let's just pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha again.